Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
Welcome to a series of special episodes in lieu of the College Congress that would have been. In this fifth and final episode, we hear from Ankur Barua, who would have chaired the session Everything You Wanted to Know About Keratoconus But Were Too Afraid to Ask. We then hear from authors of abstracts, which had been accepted for presentation as posters.
I'm now speaking with Mr. Ankur Barua, a consultant ophthalmologist specialising in the anterior segment. He was going to be chairing the session Everything You Wanted to Ask About Keratoconus But Were Too Afraid to Ask. Instead, however, we're going to be talking about that symposium on the podcast. So Ankur, thank you so much for joining me today. What have we got to expect from the session today?
Sunil, thank you very much for inviting me to start off this podcast on keratoconus. We had a symposium that was going to be very exciting, very interesting this week. And I think doing this podcast will be a very good way of introducing the audience to what they could have heard and hopefully will hear in the future in future symposiums. So I've selected a few of the speakers that would have been speaking this week, good colleagues of mine who are experts in their field. First of all, we have Mr. Ricardo Vinciguerra, who's one of my previous colleagues at Birmingham Midland Eye Centre, and he's now working in Milan as a consultant. He has a very strong background in keratoconus as a disease process and treatments of keratoconus, including cross-linking. So he'll be able to talk about the pathophysiology and the biomechanics of the cornea and try and relate that to the clinical aspects as well, making it as interesting as possible for the wide audience that we have. After that, we have Mr. Damien Lake, who's one of my previous colleagues from Queen Victoria Hospital. He's going to be focusing on the surgical aspect of keratoconus. Now, there's been a huge change in the ability to treat keratoconus patients in recent years. And there's a lot of new techniques and new technology that's come out for treatment of these patients. And it'll give the audience an insight into what there is and what there may be in the future as well. We then have Dr. Trusset Dave, who's a contact lens specialist who's worked with me in the past in Coventry. And he's going to give the audience enough knowledge to last them for a lifetime on contact lenses, all the applications for contact lenses in keratoconus and what the limitations are as well, as it's important to know where contact lenses fit into the treatment and management of keratoconus. Finally, we have Professor Sunil Shah, who's a colleague of mine at BMEC, and he'll be giving us an insight into the future of keratoconus and concluding remarks on any final tips and tricks with management of keratoconus patients.
Well, great, that sounds really interesting. But you know, first we're going to talk about keratoconus in general. So Ankur, you know, how is the epidemiology of keratoconus changing? I mean, in my experience, I feel that I'm seeing more patients with keratoconus in the clinic, but is that true?
Well, it's a very interesting question because keratoconus is a condition which we don't know much about. We do have a basic kind of knowledge of what might be causing keratoconus, but we don't know the real reasons of what really happens in keratoconus in terms of how it presents, why it presents in some people and not others. I mean, there is a clear genetic aspect of keratoconus, and there's evidence that environmental factors play a role as well. The traditional thinking is, oh, anyone who rubs their eyes may develop keratoconus. But again, not everyone who rubs their eyes will develop keratoconus. Furthermore, there's other systemic conditions that may be linked to keratoconus, and there may be increased prevalence. And also, there's a link with different ethnic populations. So we know already that the risks are higher in those of Asian descent and Caucasians as well. And the risk of keratoconus may vary amongst different countries in terms of incidence and environmental factors as well within each area and climate. So there's a lot of things that we could talk about in terms of what could trigger off keratoconus. And we've read before about things such as a two-hit hypothesis and how there is a genetic component which may be triggered off by an environmental component which may cause keratoconus to express itself. And then we've got other patients who may not have any symptoms of keratoconus, and then they come in to be seen by a specialist and are told they've got a mild version of keratoconus, which is otherwise known as form-fused keratoconus. Now, we don't know the true incidence of that type of keratoconus. We don't know whether those patients would have developed it if their environmental factors triggered it off. And furthermore, We know that eye rubbing is linked, but there have been plenty of studies that have linked the two, but we don't know how many patients will develop it if they do rub their eyes, if they've got a genetic link. So those questions are very important. But the other thing we have found is with the advent of cross-linking, we're finding that a lot more of our wider community, wider advanced healthcare professional community, are aware of keratoconus and the implications of not spotting keratoconus. So I think there's a lot more recognition of the disease process itself, both amongst optometrists in the community, optometrists in hospital, and amongst hospital specialists as well, general ophthalmologists. So I think we're getting more referrals based on the fact that people are recognising those patients who wouldn't have been recognised at an early stage in the past. Finally, I'd like to also add on that we are seeing an increase in the age range of patients presenting with keratoconus. And again, it's difficult to ascertain what's causing this. So as a paediatric corneal specialist myself as well, I do see many patients presenting with keratoconus at an earlier age, as young as 5-6 years. And I'm seeing more and more patients presenting younger than 18 who have rapidly progressing keratoconus that need treatment. On the other hand, I'm seeing patients that are presenting later on that might not have had keratoconus early on in life. So there is a wider spread of the types of keratoconus that we're seeing and the age ranges that we're seeing. So it's a really interesting area which we've got a lot more to learn about in the future.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And I think it's, you know, really pertinent that you mentioned, you know, there's a balance between, is the number of patients increasing with keratoconus, or is it just, you know, an increased number of referrals, as you said, as the awareness of cross-linking and other treatments is increasing too? It makes me think, are we performing far fewer surgeries these days then for keratoconus because of cross-linking?
Well, the natural answer to that would be yes, we would be doing less surgeries if more patients are having corneal cross-linking. Now, the misconception that's commonly held is that patients often come in saying, okay, I'm going to have cross-linking and the vision is going to get better, isn't it? So the first step is to identify the two different treatment plans for patients with keratoconus. You need to identify those who have progressive keratoconus as per NICE guidelines with cross-linking. And then you need to recognise those patients who have keratoconus that may have been stable for a while. It's common for patients to come in to our clinics saying that we've heard about cross-linking and I need cross-linking because I've got keratoconus. That's the first thing we need to really identify amongst the different patients that we see. Now, in terms of those patients, there are a large proportion of patients who have had keratoconus for a long time, who have very poor vision, are dependent on contact lenses. And even with contact lenses, they don't have great vision because they might have anterior stromal scarring, previous high drops. So those patients would be the patients who would need visual rehabilitation. And nowadays, we can combine that with corneal grafting techniques, or combine that with other techniques that might help get them the best possible vision. Cross-linking is more of an adjunct to be able to stabilise the cornea. So think of cross-linking as a way of stopping, of preventing or reducing the risk of progression of the cornea. And that gives you more of a firm foundation, and you haven't got a moving target with which to improve the vision with. Now, there is also a school of thought where some patients who have cross-linking may get flattening with time, so their vision may change. So as a rough idea, if you have 50% of patients who get a flattening of the cornea within a year after cross-linking, not all of them will get an improvement in the vision, even though the figures might improve. In terms of the measurements, those might improve, but that doesn't always equate to a noticeable change in the vision. So in terms of the patients that we're seeing, we are still dealing with a significant proportion of patients who haven't had the opportunity to have cross-linking and aren't able to have cross-linking because they don't reach the criteria and will still need grafts in the future. So I don't see this immediate change at the moment of less patients need corneal grafts. I am, however, seeing more patients able to have partial thickness corneal grafts, such as deep anterior lamellar keratoplasty. I think in the future, with more prevalent surgical options, such as what Mr. Lake is going to talk about, we're going to probably see a change in the type of operations that we're doing for keratoconus patients, and probably less grafts.
Do you feel that there's a big variation across the country in the way that cross-linking is offered or the way that it's accessible?
That's, again, another really interesting question. That's something that we're actually looking at the moment. We have a local West Midlands forum where all the corneal specialists discuss things, and we've actually found out that there's such a variance in the way that we do things in cornea. Now, there's a lot of things that could explain that. The first thing is that the original protocol for cross-linking was developed from Wollensack, and that protocol has changed with time because we've got newer types of cross-linking treatments available. There's accelerated cross-linking. There's all these new types of riboflavin drops available. So the protocols are changing with the newer types of solutions and newer types of machines that are available. On top of that, each consultant has their own pet kind of things that they prefer. So they have different post-operative routines, they have different preparatory routines, they have different ways in which they see the patients and do the cross-linking, different protocols themselves that they use. And we found out in the West Midlands group that there is a variation. And that doesn't necessarily mean that one group will do worse than the other. Each department has probably developed their own with time and have got very good results. So it's really important that we look nationwide, and I'm very interested in doing a study on a national basis to look at how different protocols have developed in each unit that offers cross-linking. It's important to realise that not every unit, not even every corneal unit offers corneal cross-linking. So there's different pathways that each department and each region has as well. So that'd be a really interesting thing to look at, to see how corneal cross-linking is offered within each region and within each trust, and whether each trust is able to offer the same cross-linking protocols that the one next to it offers, and where the patient goes and what pathway the patient follows. Because ultimately, we're doing the best we can for the patient, and obviously the patient journey should be as smooth and efficient as possible.
I mean, yes, it sounds like there's, you know, particular nuances that different departments or clinicians may have in terms of when they may choose to offer cross-linking. But, you know, from a trainee's perspective, could you summarise perhaps, you know, with respect to topography changes, when would you recommend considering cross-linking?
Yeah, I'm more than happy to go through that. In preparation for that answer, I need to also go through what the trainees may experience. I've found that the way in which keratoconus is managed is very different amongst different units. So it's important for each trainee, and this is the first piece of advice I'd give, is to find out what the service is like in their local unit, whether it be when they're as an attachment in the corneal unit or as a trainee generally seeing general patients, of which may include keratoconus patients. And if you do get patients that come in which have keratoconus, how you manage them in terms of referral pathways. So it's really important for the trainee to actually recognise the corneal pathways that are there and recognise which units offer cross-linking in their region. They may find that their unit offers cross-linking, so it'll be a good idea to see what happens in the unit and who does the cross-linking, because a lot of cross-linking units are run primarily by a overall consultant or a consultant group, but then there's corneal nurses, there's specialist optometrists, and it's almost like an AMD service as such, because patients come through on a pathway, like I did in Coventry, where they come through as a primary referral, they get seen, and the decision is there made if they need cross-linking or not, or the decision is made whether they're too far gone for cross-linking, or the decision is made whether they need monitoring to look for progression, and then whether cross-linking is needed. There's so many different variables. So there can be a blanket answer in terms of this is what you need to do if a patient comes to you, because there's so many different possibilities of how a patient can present to a trainee. In terms of the basics, it's really important to get a very thorough history from the patient as to when they come in with a potential diagnosis of keratoconus, where they've come from, if they come from a local optometrist who sent it to a local hospital eye service, and to find out whether the patient's ever been told before that they have keratoconus. You may find just from the history that actually if the prescription hasn't changed in terms of the refractive prescription and their vision really hasn't changed, you may find that a lot of these patients actually have had keratoconus for a while and there's not been any change. It's just that the person who's referring through has spotted themselves that there's keratoconus. So it's really important to establish the history. It's also important to establish whether there's been a change and how long the change has been going on for. So whether the change has been going for the last year, whether the prescription has been changing and they've noticed it themselves, and whether there's any risk factors as well. So simple things to ask is, are there any associated eye diseases that they've had before? Do they suffer from things like allergic eye disease, which is a risk factor for eye rubbing, which in turn is a risk factor for progression of keratoconus? And whether they've had any treatment before. So some patients get missed in the fact that they've actually had laser eye surgery in the past and no one's actually spotted it in the history. So this could be a different pathway. This patient has potentially got post-laser ectasia. Also, obviously, you need to ask about family history and whether there's any triggers that might have happened that have triggered off this reason for the vision to change. It's really important for the trainee as well to not focus on the keratoconus itself. Once you've spotted the keratoconus, you have to realise that these patients may have other conditions with the eye, and they may also have systemic conditions as well. For example, some patients may have floppy eyelid syndrome, and it's important to address these issues. So it makes it as easy as possible for the tertiary referral unit to be able to take these things on and have a proper full history to work off. If the trainee has access to a topography, it's also important to find out what type of machine they have. Now, the gold standard machine that we use at the moment is called a Pentacam. I'm sure most people have heard of a Pentacam. The advantage of a Pentacam is because it's Schleinflug and it's able to measure the anterior and posterior surfaces, it could theoretically identify keratoconus at a relatively early stage. So even if a patient says the vision's a bit blurry and the vision may still be relatively good, it's still a good way of identifying keratoconus and also monitoring progression as well. In terms of progression, every unit will have a different way of identifying what they class as progression. And again, there's guidelines that we go off. So for example, in terms of progression, we could look at several indices on the Pentacam. So people probably would have heard of the anterior curvature and the steepness on the cornea. So there's a couple of things I look at, including K1 and K2 readings. And if we have previous scans, so if we have two scans to compare to with a difference in time, in terms of maybe we've got a scan from a year ago, if we're looking for progression, we could look for changes in terms of 1 diopter, 1.2 diopters in terms of the K1 or K2. We could also look at the K-mean as well and see if that's changed over the year. And we could also look at the K-max, which is the steepest point on the surface. The other thing not to forget about is the thickness of the cornea. So the thinning of the cornea is one of the signs of progression of keratoconus. So if the cornea becomes progressively thinner, not necessarily at the central point, so it's a misconception to look at the central corneal thickness. You need to look at the thinnest point, which is not often in the centre. And you could see that quite easily on the Pentacam. Furthermore, you want to look at the change in the refraction as well. So you do need to look at other indices apart from just the ones available on the Pentacam. There's so much information on the Pentacam that people often get kind of lost in the amount of information that's available on the Pentacam. So there are things like the Bellin Ambrosio score, which is very useful. There's also the ABCD grading as well. So there are ways, especially in terms of the Pentacam software, and to look at progression and to look for changes available. But each unit will be different in terms of what they classify as progression. Some units may determine progression differently for advanced keratoconus versus mild to moderate keratoconus. And furthermore, you need to look at the way in which the scan was taken. You need to look at the quality of the scan. You also need to look at the history just before the scan was taken. So has a patient got a background of quite dry eye? Is the quality poor in terms of the capture of the image? Was it difficult for the technician to take the image? And also you need to remember that some of these patients will already be in contact lenses. So you really need to ask the patient, have they worn contact lenses? Or this should already really be in place, as the patient should have been asked to take the contact lenses off before they came in for the keratoconus progression assessment.
As you've said, there seems to be a big variation in the way that keratoconus services are run across the country. But how do you run your keratoconus service?
So I've been in a couple of units as a fellow and as a consultant, not only utilising the already established services that I have, which has been very useful, but also developing my own services as well. So in terms of identifying patients, the crucial thing in keratoconus is getting an early referral. So that's the first crucial thing. So we'll hear later on from our colleagues who are speaking about the importance of recognising keratoconus in the community and the ways in which we could recognise keratoconus at an early stage. The gold standard may not be the pentacam for much longer. There's many other ways of looking for very early keratoconus. There's also ways of bringing the patient in on potentially a virtual service to be able to almost weed out those patients who don't need keratoconus and are stable, and recognising those patients who potentially might progress or are progressing, and then getting them into a pathway where they could have cross-linking if indicated. And then identifying those patients who may not be suitable for cross-linking due to one reason or another. Often it's because their keratoconus is too advanced and they're not able to have cross-linking for that reason. So in a keratoconus pathway in a hospital service, it is important to have the different, first the equipment available to be able to do this, and secondly to have the service available afterwards to deal with the capacity of the patients that come in. So if you don't have a cross-linking service, it's important to liaise closely with a cross-linking service that is available to find a referral pathway that would be suitable for them and for your hospital as well. So getting these patients in, you may decide that actually it's better for these patients not to go via you in a hospital that doesn't offer keratoconus. It might be better for that referral pathway to happen directly to that department that does offer cross-linking. So in Coventry, where I was, we developed a keratoconus pathway where patients would come in, would have their assessment done, would have all their imaging done, and then they'd be seen by an optometrist who's a specialist optometrist who'd be able to do a refraction that's well suited for keratoconus individuals, where the refractions tend to be more challenging, and they tend to be more time involved with the refraction for these patients. And then after that, they see another optometrist who's able to do a full assessment, a full history, a full assessment with a dilated fundal examination. And then there's an overall consultant that manages these patients in association with a corneal nurse who may do any extra tests that may be needed. And then the decision is made on which pathway this patient will end up following. Will the patient follow a cross-linking pathway, or will the patient not be suitable for cross-linking and be on a monitoring pathway? Or has the patient already had cross-linking elsewhere in the past and will need to be on a follow-up pathway with combination of the cross-linking, potential cross-linking in the future if they progress further, or whether they need to go into a contact lens clinic where we need to just monitor them on a yearly basis or so. So there's so many different pathways that these patients could follow, that it's important to have a blueprint of how to run the service and how best to serve these patients without having them languishing in general clinics where they may not get all the tests that they need and may come in when there's no topography available on that day, or there's no access to having scans or images done or refractions done. So it's really important to have this service in place so that patients follow the route of least resistance.
Earlier on when we were speaking, you mentioned that there were a number of environmental factors which may predispose patients to developing keratoconus. For example, eye rubbing. I was just wondering, when you do see patients in the clinic, do you give them any specific lifestyle advice? And, you know, with regards to eye rubbing specifically, is there any way that we can assess them objectively to find out, are they rubbing their eyes?
That's, again, a really good question. So I'll answer that in two parts. So the first thing is about environmental factors. So eye rubbing is a difficult thing to assess. It's difficult to ask a patient, do you rub your eye? Because you almost get an answer of either yes or no, or I'm not sure. So it's difficult to assess. And there have been a couple of studies that have looked at, well, there have been quite a few studies that have looked at eye rubbing. And all of these studies have found it difficult to quantify exactly how much eye rubbing there is, because it's very difficult to assess the duration of eye rubbing, the intensity of eye rubbing, and when patients eye rub themselves, because often patients might not know that they're rubbing their eyes. So in terms of the environmental factors, rubbing the eyes may be linked to some other condition that's making the patient rub their eyes. So the most common one that you think of naturally would be this patient may have dry eyes or irritated eyes, and that often leads to eye rubbing. So in a setting where we're seeing the patient for the first time in clinic as a potential keratoconus patient, it's really important, and this is one of the things where we use an optometrist and we use our corneal nurse, to do all these assessments beforehand to look for these potential risk factors. So if a patient has ocular surface disease, and I'm seeing a lot of patients nowadays with lid margin disease that I probably wouldn't have seen a few years ago, and there's loads of ideas as to why that may be happening. The environment's changing, pollution levels are changing, COVID's a very topical thing at the moment. So we're talking about the reduction in pollution and whether it's influencing dry eye. There's so many interesting things that could come out of this. But the main thing is if someone's got dry eye, it's not either yes or no. You need to find out what type of dry eye this patient has got. So if the patient's got a dry eye related to lipid deficiency status, then you need to look at the lid margin. So some of these patients may have lid margin disease, staphylococcal hypersensitivity. They may have underlying blepharitis and gland disease that might be irritating the surface of the eye, causing this feeling of irritated dry eyes where they may feel the need to rub their eyes. So if you get to the source of the problem causing the rubbing, then you may need to see what we could do to prevent the rubbing in the first place and breaking that cycle. So it's very difficult to assess and quantify how much rubbing they have. But the fact that the patient admits to rubbing, you automatically need to act upon that. Because even if you do cross-linking on these patients, if they carry on rubbing their eye, the cross-linking may not last forever. And we actually don't know truly how long cross-linking will last for. Cross-linking's got very, very good data so far. It's a relatively safe procedure. It seems to be long-lasting in most patients from the data that we have so far. But there are a few select patients where we need to monitor a bit closely. So I know for a fact that from the patients that I've managed before, atopic individuals do worse after cross-linking. They take longer to heal. They have more ocular surface disease. So it's important for me to recognise these patients beforehand and manage these patients beforehand. So you need to treat the ocular surface before you do the cross-linking because you want to break the cycle of progression. Cross-linking just creates more cross-links or creates a more kind of stable cornea or a more rigid cornea. It doesn't mean that will last forever. Those cross-links may break down in the future. And actually with cross-linking, we don't know whether we're forming more cross-links or we're emphasising the links that are already there. We don't know where we're increasing, in terms of what Ricardo is going to talk later on about, we don't actually know exactly what the pathophysiology is and how cross-linking works. There's so many different ideas. There's the role of oxygen, there's a role of temperature, there's a role of what the conditions are in the patient afterwards, the role of haze in the cornea afterwards. So there's so many different things that are being actively looked at the moment as we speak. So in terms of eye rubbing, the aim for us as a priority is we know that that's a potential risk factor. We know there's papers linking eye rubbing to progression of keratoconus, but we need to identify that and manage that as much as we can before the patient goes down the route of treatment. So this is conservative management in terms of lubricating drops to help the ocular surface stay free from preservatives. So I tend to go for preservative-free drops. I tend to use antihistamines if they have a background of allergic eye disease or seasonal hay fever. I also try and manage atopes with anti-inflammatory drops. I have been increasingly using moderate to severe allergic eye disease patients with very effective drops such as cyclosporin, short course of steroid drops, preservative-free steroids, and even in some cases, tacrolimus to help control the ocular surface before any surgical management. So there is a role of reducing the eye rubbing and getting the patient to know that eye rubbing is one of the few things that they could do to minimise the risk of progression. It's important to tell the patient that stopping the eye rubbing isn't going to mean that they're going to that's going to cure the keratoconus and get their vision better. It's one of the things that I emphasise to the patients that reducing your eye rubbing or trying to stop eye rubbing may help with you in the future and may avoid the need for further treatment in the future in terms of repeat cross-linking. But these patients often come at a stage where they're already progressing, so you need to talk to them about surgical options as well.
Other environmental factors, is there any evidence or literature to suggest that there's other factors which may predispose the patient to develop keratoconus?
Yeah, I mentioned before about the increased prevalence of people of Asian descent having potentially 5 to 6 plus times more risk of keratoconus than other populations. And this is something that there's ongoing research on this. And one thing that I'm really interested in at the moment is the role of ocular surface disease, in particular in relation to vitamin D levels as well. Now, vitamin D is implicated in a lot of things at the moment, but in particular, what we're interested in is, does vitamin D deficiency relate to potential progression of keratoconus, potential dry eye syndrome, and potential inflammation of the ocular surface, and whether increasing the vitamin D levels to a more normal level would be able to counteract some of the effects of this in terms of keratoconus progression, in terms of recovery from keratoconus treatment such as cross-linking. So I have at the moment a really big interest in the vitamin D role in keratoconus. There's been a few specialists across the world who've been looking at this, and we've been in webinars recently where, you know, there's been discussion about this. But it would be interesting to look at that in more detail within the UK, and whether there's a clear correlation between people who have vitamin D deficiency, which there is a lot of in the UK, and risk of progression of keratoconus, and also recovery from treatment for keratoconus with cross-linking. Other environmental factors I mentioned already in terms of systemic disease, in terms of floppy eyelid syndrome. So I do know that I have a select group of patients who have these collagen diseases such as floppy eyelid, where they get this rapidly progressive keratoconus where we need to treat it aggressively, and they tend to present a bit later. So they may develop floppy eyelid syndrome later in life, and then they develop keratoconus at an unusually late stage in life. And they may develop other ectasias such as pellucid marginal degeneration. So that would be another aspect to look at, because there's no gold standard treatment for floppy eyelid syndrome either. So managing this is very challenging in these patients. So having this awareness is really important. I'm not saying that every patient with keratoconus needs vitamin D, but that's something to be aware of. But I do strongly promote the use of pre-treatment prior to cross-linking. So managing the ocular surface before cross-linking is really important to get the best result afterwards and minimise the ongoing inflammation that often happens. Because traditionally we think of keratoconus as a non-inflammatory disorder, but I think it is triggered by inflammatory conditions.
Well, Ankur, thank you so much for discussing all those points with me. It's been really, really useful. And I look forward to the rest of the episode.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well. I'm looking forward to hear what the other speakers have to say. We've got a very, very exciting program for the next couple of podcasts. So it'll be really interesting to see what the feedback's like from the audience in general. And hopefully we'll be able to do the seminar in real life, face-to-face in the future, hopefully next year in the College Congress. Thank you, Sunil.
That was really interesting, and I hope you found that interview useful. The remaining interviews with speakers from the Keratoconus Symposium will be published on the next episode of Eye to Eye. Now for some more interviews with abstract authors. I'm now speaking with Andrew Swampillai, an ophthalmology registrar who works at the Musgrove Park Hospital in Taunton. He spoke with me about his work, Confidence of UK Ophthalmic Trainees in Managing Posterior Capsular Rupture, results from a National Trainee Clinical Research Network survey. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining me today to talk about your work. Could you tell the listeners a bit about your study?
Well, first of all, Sunil, thanks very much for allowing me to talk about this. So our study was a survey that we conducted last year, which was set up by our local trainee research network called SWARM, which stands for Southwest Ophthalmology Research Matrix. And what we did was we sent an anonymous 11-STEM questionnaire to all trainees in the United Kingdom from the levels of ST2 to ST7 to get them to self-evaluate themselves as to how they would manage posterior capsular rupture and how confident they felt at various aspects of the procedure. So for example, recognising that a PC rupture had occurred, or choosing the right settings for anterior vitrectomy, being able to place an intraocular lens in the sulcus, or deciding when to leave the eye aphakic. And the survey was based on an initial regional survey that was conducted back in 2016. And I believe this took place in the Wessex Deanery. And so what we did was we sort of built on that survey and we expanded it nationwide.
That sounds really interesting. Out of interest, how did you distribute the survey and what was the response rate like?
So our survey was distributed on an online platform called SurveyMonkey. We appointed survey leads in every deanery in the United Kingdom to basically cascade the survey down to all trainees, whether it be via email or through WhatsApp groups. We were also fortunate enough to have a few training program directors who were very supportive of us, and they certainly egged their trainees to fill out the survey as well as much as possible. In terms of the response rate, we had a total number of 248 responders who kindly filled out the online survey, so thank you very much to them. And give or take, every year there's around roughly 700 trainees in the United Kingdom, so the response rate is around 33%. I do acknowledge that this is a limitation of the study, but nonetheless, the responses that we got and the overall picture that was certainly gleaned from the survey data does make quite interesting reading nonetheless.
Okay, and were you surprised by the results?
So I think the honest answer to that question is yes and no. I think sort of talking anecdotally to other trainees, both at my level or maybe even above or slightly below, there is a general consensus that posterior capsular rupture is something that we all dread, obviously, but I think the reason that we dread it the most is because we have that sort of doubt as to whether we can manage it as efficiently as possible or as well as we would like to, rather. And I think this primarily arises from the fact that the opportunities to get hands-on experience in managing this complication are few and far between, thankfully. One of the things that we found from our survey was when we asked all trainees of all training grades from ST2 to ST7 how confident they felt in managing posterior capsular rupture without senior support, only 77 responders felt that they could manage this without having a consultant by the side. So that's only around 31% of all our responders, and this does give pause for thought, because it's quite possible in our training to go throughout one ST1 to ST7 without having ever done an anterior vitrectomy by ourselves, and this is something that clearly needs remedying. One of the other aspects that we paid quite a lot of attention to, which was quite reassuring however, was that at ST6 to ST7 level, which is usually around the level that you're pretty much doing independent cataract surgery, we did ask them how many of those trainees would feel that they would be able to manage capsular rupture independently, and around 77% of them said they would. So clearly there is some good news here, and I think this is something that we do need to sort of certainly keep up. As you're also aware, Sunil, simulation is playing a bigger part in our training than it did in previous years. One of the things that we took care to ask was where the trainees had access to relevant simulation in regards to managing capsular rupture and performing anterior vitrectomy. And around 66% of trainees said that they felt they had the relevant materials available to them, whether it be through the ISI or through using Model Eyes. And again, this is clearly something that's quite reassuring, but it does illustrate that there is room for improvement in getting all trainees up and down the country to be able to access simulation that will put them in good stead for managing a capsular rupture.
Okay, and you know, based upon your results, would you have any recommendations, you know, either for trainees, units, training program directors, or even the college?
So I think a number of recommendations can be made from our survey data, as you point out. So for trainees, certainly what I would suggest, particularly for those of you that are starting to undertake independent cataract surgery, I think it is very important that you familiarise yourself with the anterior vitrectomy settings on your phaco machine. There is a wealth of information and education that's available online, such as iTube or even YouTube, which do show real-life cases of when a posterior capsular rupture occurs and where you can look out for those little subtle telltale signs of when a capsular rupture has occurred, such as the snapback of the pupil or the sudden deepening of the anterior chamber. And I would certainly encourage trainees to make use of that. There are a number of wet labs that are run nationally. I do know of one that's run by the United Kingdom and Ireland Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons, which I've been on and which I know a few other trainees have been on and have remarked is quite good. There are also workshops that occur at conferences such as ESCRS and ASCRS, which are geared to teaching residents about this particular issue as well. And certainly if trainees are in a situation where they do attend such conferences, that they can make use of those wet labs, which are made available to them either free or at very discounted prices. I think it also bears mentioning that if you are particularly a senior trainee and you happen to be with your trainer, that it might be worth mentioning to them that should you be unfortunate enough to encounter such a complication, or even in a similar situation such as zonulodialysis, whether they could certainly supervise you trying to perform the initial management stages of vitreous loss management. And I think this is somewhere where trainees do have to take the initiative and seek out those opportunities as and when they occur, because it's quite easy to take a step back and be passive and just be an observer, but you will not learn the fundamentals of managing this complication if you don't put yourself out there, grab those opportunities when they arise. In terms of what units can do, there was a paper that came out quite recently from a consultant in Scotland, I believe, by the name of David Lockington, who suggested that every eye unit should have an anterior vitrectomy drill kit. What he meant by that was having all the materials in a box which could be easily located by theatre staff, so that when a posterior capsular rupture did occur, the theatre staff knew exactly where and when to locate the box, and it had everything to hand so that it could be laid out on the trolley as quickly as possible. And this is something that saves on a lot of stress, and both for the surgeon but also for the patient as well, because we do forget that the patient can more often than not sense that something has gone wrong. So I think being able to stop fakeing and to try to transfer onto managing vitreous loss as seemingly as possible is something that is beneficial for all concerned, really.
Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. That was really interesting.
I'm now joined by Rachel Healy, a specialty trainee who works at the Bristol Eye Hospital. We spoke about her paper entitled 10-Year Outcomes in Neovascular Age-Related Macular Degeneration Treated with Anti-VEGF. Rachel, thank you very much for speaking to me today. Could you tell the listeners a bit about your paper?
Hi, Sunil. Thank you for inviting me on the podcast. Yes, of course. So I did a study when I was working at Gloucestershire Hospitals last year, analysing the 10-year outcomes for patients with neovascular AMD who'd been treated with anti-VEGF. I found that we had 98 previously treatment-naive eyes included in this study, and they had all received their first treatment prior to 2010 and had a minimum follow-up of 120 months. The primary outcomes of my study were the visual acuity and the change from baseline to 120 months, as well as the drugs that they were given and any treatment changes that they had, visual acuity status at the end, and driving status.
And you've collected a huge amount of data there, and 10 years worth of data is, you know, very impressive. How did you actually collect that amount of data?
So fortunately, in 2006, Gloucestershire Hospital started using Medisoft Ophthalmology, and so all data was captured in real time, and that includes both the visual acuities, the drugs that were given in terms of injections, as well as the OCT data, which was automatically transferred from the OCT machine straight into Medisoft. So we conducted a retrospective analysis, but all of this was real-time data capture, so we can be quite reassured that all of this data was really rather accurate.
I mean, that's, you know, quite lucky, and actually quite jealous when I think back to how I've previously done audits, you know, in my medical retina rotations. So how did your data compare to the existing literature?
Well, there've been quite a few studies looking at the clinical outcomes after a year or two of anti-VEGF treatments, but there've been fairly few after that. The main study is a study called the 7-UP trial, which looked at patients 7 to 8 years after the initialisation of treatment. However, there haven't been any studies done looking at 10-year outcomes, and so that's why this study was really interesting to us. What we actually did is we compared our results at 10 years to those of the 7-UP study, and we found that we had remarkably similar results at 10 years compared to the 7-UP study, which was obviously at 7 years. The main reason that we think that that is likely is that we found that we were treating patients more rigorously than the 7-UP study. So whereas the 7-UP study, after the first 3 years, were only averaging 1.5 injections per year, our patients on average were having at least 4 per year up until 10 years.
Could you tell us a bit about the demographics of your patients?
Absolutely. So the median age at baseline was 76, and the majority of our patients who made it to 10 years were female, with 74%. They had an average visual acuity at baseline in terms of ETDRS letters of 60, and the mean visual acuity in the study eye at 120 months was 47, so a mean letter score drop of 13 letters. The interesting thing, though, is that we found that nearly a third of patients managed to maintain a visual acuity with no letter scores drop at 120 months.
That's really interesting. I'm curious, you know, do you know what proportion of patients ended up developing bilateral disease during your study period?
Yes, so four of the patients at baseline were had bilateral exudative AMD at the beginning of the study, and both of those eyes were included in our study. But by 120 months, a total of 27 patients had been diagnosed with neovascular AMD bilaterally and had also received injections in their other eye as well.
Your study sounds really impressive. A huge amount of data, and you've collected it in a really rigorous and robust way using electronic medical records. But I was wondering, are there any limitations of the study that you think are worth mentioning?
Well, the retrospective methodology obviously does mean that we do rely on the data being accurately inputted at the time, which we obviously can't completely guarantee. Also, purely the nature of the study shows that it is affected by selection bias, in that only those who've had a clinical appointment 10 years or more after their first injection were included. And therefore, those patients who were no longer under hospital follow-up, either because their condition had become quiescent or they'd been discharged or for other health reasons, they wouldn't have been included in the results of this study. And unfortunately, these numbers weren't something we were able to capture within the data.
Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that concludes our five-part series of content from College Congress. I really hope you've enjoyed it and found it useful. The next episode of Eye to Eye will feature interviews with speakers from the Keratoconus Symposium. I'd just like to give a special thanks to our more than 20 guest speakers and the team at the college, especially Liz, Jake and Julie, who have put in a massive amount of work behind the scenes to make this series possible. As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.